Question. What does Sai Baba say about death? Answer. The moment of death is perhaps the highest point of our existence on earth, the culmination of our life's work, and a moment of crucial importance for us. Baba has said that what becomes of us after death is determined by what we think at the moment of dying, and that we should prepare for it throughout our life. If our thoughts and our heart, our being, have been with God throughout our life, and our most basic yearning has been for contact with God, if we have so permeated our lives with this yearning that at the moment of death we still hold steadily to it, then this is precisely where we will go, to God. And likewise, if we have been caught up in competition, pride, or lust, the more animalistic elements of our nature, then we will make the transition to that level of consciousness. For many of the educated and scientifically oriented of our culture, it is hard to believe so unscientific a tenet as that we might actually continue to exist in some manner beyond this life on earth. Before meeting Baba, I thought it futile to think about life after death and to prepare for an existence I knew nothing about. I used to rationalize that such a belief wouldn't affect one's life anyway. But I now see that one's life changes dramatically in relation to his attitudes about death. There appears to be a growing and syncretic body of evidence from the experience of apparently credible individuals to substantiate the ancient religious teachings that death is only a transition from this plane of existence to another. We get the strongest message about the reality of dimensions beyond the physical plane from the great spiritual masters who have experienced them through expanded consciousness. Often, they bring back evidence of the existence of these dimensions. For example, by returning with a pertinent and meaningful message from a devotee's dead relative whom the master has never met. There is also evidence in the fascinating reports from people on the verge of dying, in fact, in some cases actually declared dead, who have experienced their consciousness move into directions and spaces they had never experienced before, and have come back to life in this world with the experience still vivid and sublime in their minds. Recent psychological studies of people about to encounter what appeared to be certain death by accident, such as falling from a plane or drowning, seem to some observers to substantiate what great seers have said about cosmic consciousness and the reality of other dimensions. The reactions of the subjects to impending death were amazingly similar. They generally reported an initial desperate searching for escape, followed by a moment when they recognized that there was no apparent escape, at which point they fell into a state of surrender or acceptance. For many, this was accompanied by a great sense of joy, release, and bliss. Some described seeing visions of their life passing before them. Others experienced a change in their consciousness as if, they said, they were entering another realm. Many who have had heart attacks and supposedly died have reported that they experienced going on a trip. They lost consciousness of their body, but were conscious of going to another place where they were safe. These people have developed from their experience great faith that there is nothing to fear about death, that it is simply a transition to another place. In the San Diego Union newspaper, dated May 25, 1975, there was an article about a well-known psychiatrist who had made some interesting observations about the dying and dead. Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who has studied the subject of death for over 10 years, stated, quote, "They died and experienced peace and wholeness. The blind could see, and those who suffered were free from pain. And as physicians worked to save them, they resented being brought back to life." End quote. Author of On Death and Dying, Questions and Answers About Dying, and most recently, Death, the Final Stage of Growth, Dr. Kubler-Ross said that she has drawn a number of conclusions from hundreds of interviews with people who have survived a brush with death. She has found that they resent being brought back to life, but after recovery are exuberant about having a second chance. Past a certain threshold, many are greeted by someone already dead, usually a loved one. None is ever again afraid to die. She describes the case of a 2-year-old boy brought to a hospital with no measurable vital functions or brain waves. He was dead of an allergic drug reaction. Doctors brought him back to life. "I know I was dead," the child told his mother afterward. He claimed that while he was dead, he saw Jesus and Mary. "It was so beautiful there," he said, "that he came back only because Mary told him to save Mommy from the fire." In another case, a woman who was suffering from a large malignancy died in a small Indiana hospital. 3.5 hours later, resuscitating teams brought her back to life. The woman said that while dead, she felt herself floating out of her body and then saw her own corpse. According to Dr. Kubler-Ross, the woman described the actions of the resuscitating team in perfect detail. She also described the fantastic feeling of peace and wholeness, the investigator reported. She tried to convey to those fighting for her life to relax, take it easy, it's all right to let go. But she realized they could not hear her. The more she tried to tell them to relax, the more frantic they became. She finally gave up on them, and this is in her own words, "Then I left consciousness." Dr. Kubler-Ross says that her research has made her religious in a beautifully undogmatic way. The following is a quotation from Satya Sai Baba. "Why are you afraid of death? Death is considered as something to be afraid of, something that should not be spoken about in happy circumstances. But death is neither good nor bad. You have no choice in the matter. You can't get it sooner if you welcome it, nor can you avoid it if you condemn it as bad. It is a consummation which is inevitable. From the moment of birth, the march to the cremation ground has started. Some reach the place more quickly than others. Some go by a roundabout route and arrive late. That is the only difference between one person and the other. Yet man walks about as if death is but a distant calamity. Death is but a passage from this life to the next. It is a change from old clothes to new, as the Gita says. But some cynics laugh at the comparison and ask, what about the death of newborn infants, children, youth, and middle-aged persons? Their bodies cannot, by stretching the meaning, be classified as worn out. Well, the clothes might not be old, but the cloth out of which they were made must have been from very old stock. Though new clothes were prepared out of it, they are to be discarded soon. Again, there are some crooked men who refuse to believe in a previous life because they cannot recollect the events. These people cannot recollect the events of a particular day, say 5 or 10 years ago, though they are certain they were alive on that day. How then can they remember or recollect events in past births? Forgetting events of that day does not mean that they were not alive at all. It only means that they did not pay any special heed to them, and they had no special reason to keep them in memory. Remember death. The body is the car in which you are riding to death. You may meet death any moment while riding. Some tree or lorry, culvert or slush will bring it about. If you remember that time is running out every moment, you will not be tempted to waste time in idle talk or vain pursuits, wanton mischief, or vulgar entertainment. Travel in the car carefully, slowly, and with due regard for the needs of others on the road. Do not greedily try to overtake others or compete in speed. Know the limitations of the vehicle and the road. Then you will not meet with any accident. Your journey will be a happy experience for you and the rest of the people. If someone is snatched away by death on a pilgrimage to Kashi or Badrinath, you console yourself that it was an enviable way of quitting. But if you get even a mild attack of headache at Puttaparthi, you start blaming me. According to you, those who have entered this compound once should not die. If they do, your faith wavers and dwindles. Well, not even an eyelid can close or open without the Lord's will. So try to get the Lord's grace and leave all questions to be answered by Him according to His fancy. Once you take on the name of the Lord, which is sweetness itself, it will awaken all the sweetness latent in you. When you have tasted the joy, you can never for a moment exist without that sustenance. It becomes as essential as air for the lungs. Listening to some Puranic scriptural tales, you might say that it is quite enough if the name of the Lord is remembered at the very last moment of life. But it is a difficult task to recall that name in the end if you have not practiced it for years. In the surge of emotions and thoughts that will invade you at the last moment, the name of God will be submerged unless you learn from now on to bring that name to the top of your consciousness whenever you want it. There was a shopkeeper once who was inspired by the tale of Ajamila. He decided to remember the name of God with his last breath by a shortcut. He named his six sons after various gods, for he knew that he was bound to call on any one of them when he was about to die. The moment came at last, and according to program, he called the Lord by proxy, six times in all. The boys came and stood around his cot, and as he surveyed the group, the last thought that came to the dying man's mind, just when he was about to quit, was, "Alas, all of you have come away. Who will look after the shop now?" You see, his shop was his very breath all through his life, and he could not switch to God at short notice. The latent tendencies will have their say, whatever you may wish. It is no mean achievement to get the name of the Lord on one's tongue at the last moment. It needs the practice of many years, based on a deep-rooted faith and a strong character without hatred or malice. The thought of God cannot survive in a climate of greed and pride. Moreover, how do you know which is the last moment? God of death does not give notice of his arrival to take hold of you. He is not like the photographer who says, "I am clicking, are you ready?" If you wish your portrait to be hung on the walls of heaven, it must be attractive. Your stance, your pose, and your smile must be all nice, is it not? So be ready for the click, day and night, with the name ever rolling on the tongue, and the glory always radiant in the mind. Then, whenever shot, your photo will be fine. End quotation. Question. Does Baba speak about reincarnation? And who does he say he himself was in the past? Answer. Yes, Baba speaks frequently of reincarnation. He says that he is the embodiment of all forms and aspects of God that have manifested themselves for us on earth. More specifically, he describes his preceding incarnation as that of Sai Baba of Shirdi, a Muslim saint who died 8 years prior to Baba's birth and who at the time of his death stated that he would return to southern India in 8 years. Baba emphasizes his relationship to Shirdi Sai Baba by materializing vibhuti, or sacred ash. Similar to Catholicism's holy water in its spiritual significance, vibhuti is also supposed to possess great healing powers. Baba has prescribed it internally and externally for all manner of disease and injuries and materializes it continually for his followers. Shirdi Sai Baba is also supposed to have distributed ash to his devotees, but did it from his fireplace, which was constantly lit. Satya Sai Baba evidently has his fire burning in another dimension, into which he reaches to bring forth the mysteriously sweet and pungent ash. Vibhuti not only serves as an expression of the link between the two Sai Babas, but Baba has said that ash is symbolic of the universal, changeless, and infinite nature of all form. It is symbolic of the God or Atma within, that substance left when everything transient and changeable in matter has burnt away. Vibhuti also draws a relationship between Baba and Shiva. Shiva, one of the three central deities in Hindu religion, is the god of destruction, and one of his instruments is fire. By helping to burn away our desires and attachments to the body and the world of sensation, the physical plane, Shiva enables us to see that part of ourself which is eternal. Baba's relationship to Shiva doesn't end with the ash. He appears to demonstrate the destroyer aspects with many of his devotees. In the Hindu religion, and in the Christian tradition as well, the mechanism of breaking out of the bondage of our lower consciousness and rising to higher or spiritual consciousness is likened to dying. And frequently, as one draws closer to Baba, he actually feels himself dying, experiences his ego slipping away, accompanied by very real physical and emotional pain. One of the most unusual experiences with Sai Baba is this destruction of the small self, and with it, an intensification of one's love for him, as one recognizes that Baba is actually doing this in love, that it is a blessing and gift to receive this devoted attention. This, by the way, is one of the central experiences that teaches many that there is actually no difference between pleasure and pain. We recognize that we are experiencing as pain is in fact an immense gift, and that to consider it pain is only a trick of the senses. Baba says, quote, "You do not know how to make an ornament out of gold, so you give it to the smith. Why worry if he melts it and beats it and pierces it and pulls it into a wire and twists it and cuts it? Let him who knows the art shape the child into an ornament of society. Do not worry." The following quotation from Sachi Sai Baba is on Vibhuti. Quote, "The Shivaratri festival devoted to the worship of Shiva, as celebrated here, is an example for you. You might ask, Swami has often declared that all days are holy days, that there is no special rite that has to be observed on any single day. But Swami himself is pouring vibhuti on the idol and calling it abhisheka, a ritual washing. Is this right? Swami is doing so to teach you a lesson. The vibhuti abhisheka has a potent inner meaning which Swami wants you to grasp. The vibhuti is the most precious object in the truly spiritual sense. You know that Shiva burnt the god of desire, or kama, called Manmata, for he agitates the mind and confounds the confusion already existing there, into a heap of ashes. Shiva adorned himself with that ash, and thus he shone in his glory as the conqueror of desire. When kama was destroyed, prema, love, reigned supreme. When there is no desire to warp the mind, love can be true and full. What greater offering can you give God to glorify him than the ash signifying your triumph over tantalizing desire? Ash is the ultimate condition of things. It cannot undergo any further change. This abhisheka with vibhuti is done to inspire you to give up desire and offer Shiva the ashes of its destruction as the most valuable of all the articles you have earned. Ash cannot fade as flowers do in a day or two. It does not dry and disappear, or get soiled and unpotable as water does. It will not lose color as leaves do in a few hours. It does not rot as fruits do in a few days. Ash is ash forever and ever. So burn your wiles, your vices, your bad habits, and worship Shiva, rendering yourself pure in thought, word, and deed, showering on him the ash purchased in packets from the shops will not please him at all." End quotation. Question. Do you feel that the Hindu concepts of karma and reincarnation have any relationship to Judaism or Christianity? Answer. Yes. I see more similarities than differences when I investigate these spiritual doctrines. The idea of karma, that we reap what we sow, that we create our future with the slightest of our actions in each moment of the present, is akin in spirit to the golden rule, "Do unto others as you would have them do unto you." This rule reflects the spiritual truth that each of us is an interrelated part of one whole. Thus, hurting others is the same as hurting ourselves. Then, too, most religions have a concept of afterlife directly related to our actions in this life, such as Christianity's heaven and hell, In my reading of Hebrew and Christian literature, I've seen nothing to indicate that reincarnation is impossible. Paramahansa Yogananda, in his remarkably rich and fascinating book, Autobiography of a Yogi, made reference to biblical writings which indicated to him that early Christian thought accepted the idea of reincarnation and, in fact, suggested that John the Baptist and Jesus in their last incarnation were respectively the prophet Elijah and his disciple Elisha. Question: has Baba mentioned anything about life on other planets? Answer: I haven't heard him speak specifically of this, but he does say that he is the Lord among all lords and has complete mastery of every aspect of the universe. I've heard stories of his giving people gifts, supposedly from other planets. Question: what is Baba's relationship to Christ? Answer: this is a very interesting question. I have mentioned before that he has said that he is all names and all forms, that he and Christ or any form or embodiment of God are the same. But he has drawn the connection between Christ and himself in a number of very interesting ways. For instance, I have read of people who, questioning Baba's authenticity, have prayed before pictures of Christ or their favorite saint or master for a sign of Baba's spiritual stature, and the form in the picture has changed into that of Sai Baba. I have also heard of the picture of Christ in someone's worship room producing vibhuti. Then there is the very unusual story told by Dr. John Hislop, a close devotee whose account of Walter Cowan's apparent resurrection appeared earlier in this book, of Baba's breaking two twigs off a tree and placing them together in the form of a cross. He asked John what they looked like, and John replied that they looked like a cross. Baba then placed the twigs in his hand, blew on them three times, and opened his hand to reveal a wooden cross with a silver statue of Jesus on it. He said that the statue was not simply an artist's representation of Jesus, but an exact likeness of how he actually looked on the cross. The small crucifix on which the silver statue was mounted, he said, was taken from Christ's actual cross. This is Dr. Hislop's account. Baba, a large group of students from the Satya Arts and Science College at Vrindavan, and a few other people, including myself, were walking down the bank of a road to a stretch of level sand of the dry Kekanahala River bed. I was walking alongside Swami, and as we passed a bush, he reached over and pulled off a couple of twigs and held them up like a cross. Hislop, he said, what is this? Well, Swami, it is a cross, I answered. He put the twigs in his hand, closed it, and produced three rather slow breaths on it. Then he opened his hand and gave me a cross with a figure of Christ on it. Quote, this is an image of Christ on the cross, not as artists have imagined him and as historians have told about him, but as he actually, really, and truly was, with stomach pulled way in and ribs all showing, because he had had no food for 8 days. End of Swami's quote. So I said, well, the cross, Swami, tell me about that. Then he said, quote, this cross is a piece of the wood from the original cross on which Christ was crucified. Then he said something very interesting. Quote, to find a piece of that wood after 2,000 years, presented a little difficulty. End quote. I suppose that is why he breathed rather slowly three times. Usually he gives one puff and a ring or whatever just appears. I noticed something odd and asked, "Swami, what is that hole at the top of the cross?" He replied, quote, "That is the hole where they hung the cross on the standard," end quote. This is something we had never even heard of before. Pictures of Christ being crucified show the cross being planted in the ground, but according to Swami, it was hung on something, and you can actually see the hole through the wood. The cross is so small that the details on the figure of Christ escape the eye. A friend, Walter Wolf, came down to our place in Baja and took some photographs of the cross that greatly magnify the details and show the beauty of the tiny figure of Christ. When he sent me a few of the prints, my wife and I were absolutely astounded. I wrote Walter that if the pictures were seen around the world, they would create an art sensation. I'm sure it is the greatest sculpture of Christ that has ever been made. In the 8x10 enlargements, you can see the blood flowing from his forehead where he was bruised. You can see the black and dust-caked saliva at the corner of his mouth, the expression of agony, pain and suffering in his eyes and face will tear your heart. In my estimation, it is the most extraordinary object that Baba has ever produced. Why he gave it to me, I have no idea. When Walter Wolf brought some enlargements of the photograph down to our house, we were standing around the table looking at the picture and thinking of Christ and of Baba, when suddenly, from a perfectly clear sky, there was a terrible crash of thunder. Then a very strong wind blew through the house, rattling the shutters, banging the doors, and blowing the curtains. Next day, an article in the San Diego Tribune reported that a mysterious thunder and wind had come up unexpectedly from a perfectly clear sky at 5 o'clock the previous afternoon. My wife reminded me that Christ died on the cross at 5 o'clock, and that the Bible tells of thunder and earthquakes which arose suddenly. I can only conclude that there is a tremendous amount of power in that little cross. End of the quotation from Dr. Hislop. Baba may pass someone he has never met at our level of consciousness and move his hand in the air and produce a picture of the individual's favorite saint or a picture of Christ. He frequently addresses Christians on the subject of Christ's teachings, occasionally purporting to clarify a particular teaching or distortion which he says has developed as the story has been passed down. To me, the most mind-blowing event of all regarding Baba's relationship to Christ appeared Christmas Day 1972. He told a group of people, quote, "Christ said, 'He who has sent me will come again,'" end quote. To my amazement, he said that he himself is the one to whom Christ was referring. Quotation from Satya Sai Baba. And the story says, "There was a star in the sky which fell with a new light, and this led a few Tibetans and others to the place where the Savior was born. This story is read and taken on trust by man, though stars do not fall or even slide down so suddenly. What the story signifies is this. There was a huge aura of splendor illumining the sky over the village when Christ was born. This meant that he who is to overcome the darkness of evil and ignorance had taken birth, that he would spread the light of love in the heart of man and the counsels of humanity. Appearances of splendor or of other signs of the era that has dawned are natural when incarnations happen on earth. The aura of light was a sign that the darkness would be destroyed. A master arrives in answer to man's prayer. Lead us from darkness unto light. There is one point that I cannot but bring to your special notice today. At the time when Jesus was merging in the supreme principle of divinity, he communicated some news to his followers, which has been interpreted in a variety of ways by commentators and those who relish the piling of writings on writings and meaning upon meaning until it all swells up into a huge mess. The statement itself has been manipulated and tangled into a conundrum. The statement is simple. Quote, "He who sent me among you will come again." And he pointed to a lamb. The lamb is merely a symbol, a sign. It stands for the voice. Ba, ba. The announcement was of the advent of Baba. Quote, "His name will be Truth," Christ declared. Satya means truth. He wears a robe of red, a blood-red robe. Here Baba pointed to the robe he was wearing. He will be short with a crown of hair. The lamb is the sign and symbol of love. Christ did not declare that he would come again. He said, "He who sent me will come again." That Baba is this Baba. End quotation. Question: how can you be sure that Baba is not a false messiah and a manifestation of the devil? This also was prophesied in the Bible. Answer: I had always assumed that I knew reality, but witnessing Baba in India the first time proved to me that I had known nothing. Reality changed for me. It seemed to me that if such an extraordinary power existed for the good, there must also be power that was bad, but I felt little ability to judge one from the other. I was, as a matter of fact, quite frightened, creeping back to my hotel room, fearfully peering into closets and behind the shower curtain. I suddenly felt exposed and unprotected. I was unaware of what mechanisms and strengths I possessed to ward off evil powers. The question of how to tell the authentic from the false is crucial. With all kinds of evil and disruptive causes masquerading in the guise of spirituality, many people have actually concluded that everything labeled religious or spiritual should be dismissed out of hand. It is true, of course, that a misguided spiritual-like surrender to a cause can be absolutely dangerous and destructive, as has been so tragically exemplified by the Crusades, the Hitler era, and the guru drug scene of today, and even more recently by the brutal killings by the Manson family, who voiced a grotesque perversion of the spiritual attitude as a rationale for their actions. Recognizing this danger and the far-reaching implications of dedicating oneself to an individual or a cause or movement, one must make such a decision only after the most careful deliberation and with a great sense of responsibility in the matter. How, then, is one to measure a being or a movement to determine its authenticity and whether or not it is indeed worthy of one's total surrender? Since that first early fright, I have gained tremendous trust and love for Baba. First of all, I have come to believe that even though we're not aware of our own powers, We have an intuitive capacity to sense whether something is good or bad, whether or not an individual is genuine. This capacity for discernment is not a function of the senses or rational mind, but is an expression of our higher self or Atma. As we evolve, the faculty becomes keener and keener. How much faith we place in this capacity will be different for each of us, depending on how much we trust ourselves, how good our judgment has been in the past, how stable, consistent, reliable, and sensitively attuned we have been. Then, too, there is the measure of the man and the movement by the character and quality of the followers. Those gathering around Sai Baba are impressive indeed. All of the highly developed souls that have experienced Baba and with whom I have become acquainted have an overwhelming intuitive sense about his greatness and goodness. Most touched by Baba become kinder, more loving, more at peace. And in all the accounts of evil forces or the devil with which I am familiar, at no time has he disguised himself as pure love, or by working in such an untiring manner for healing and the attainment of higher spiritual consciousness among people. Finally, the lifestyle, activities, values, and powers of a real avatar have been clearly defined in Christian and Hindu scriptures. The avatar allows himself to be measured, freely displaying his greatness to help dispel doubt. Baba, in fact, refers to his powers as calling cards. These powers are not just the verbalization of vague abstractions and intellectual prattle which mask ulterior motives. What one observes and experiences are clear and concrete signs of his omniscience, omnipresence, and love, a love measured in the promotion of health and well-being for all people, everywhere.